That felt productive. What else? I swiveled some more and then put a call through to Mrs. Ochsner. She was on my mind anyway. Hello, she said, picking up at long last. Her voice was tremulous, but held a note of anticipation, as though despite the fact she was 88, anyone might be calling and anything might come to pass. I hoped I'd always feel that way myself. At the moment, I wasn't so optimistic. Hi, Julia. This is Kinsey out in California. Just a minute, dear, and I'll turn the television down. I'm watching my program. You want me to call you back in a bit? I hate to interrupt. No, no, I'd prefer talking to you. Hold on. Some moments passed, and I heard the volume of the background noise reduced to silence. Julia was apparently creeping back to the phone as fast as she could. I waited. Finally, she picked up the receiver again. I kept the picture on, she said, out of breath, though it just looks like one big blur from across the room. How are you? Frustrated at the moment, I said. I'm running out of things to do, but I wanted to ask you about Elaine's cat. I don't suppose you've seen Mingus in the last 6 months, have you? Oh, goodness, no. I hadn't even thought about him. If she's gone, he'd have to be missing too, I suppose. Well, it looks that way. The building manager here says she left that night with what looked like a cat carrier. So if she actually got to Florida, I'm assuming she'd have had him with her. I'd be willing to swear he never got here any more than she did, but I could check with vets and kennels in the area, Julia said. Maybe she boarded him out for some reason. Could you do that? It would really save me some time. I don't know that you'll turn up anything, but at least we'll know we tried. I'm going to see if I can trace the taxicab she took and find out if she had the cat with her when she went to the airport. Did Pat Usher ever mention him? Not that I recall. She's gone, you know. Moved out lock, stock, and barrel. Oh, really? Well, I'm not surprised, but I would like to know where she is. Could you get her forwarding address from the Mikowskis? I'll call you back in a day or two, but don't you dare call Pat yourself. I don't want her to know you're involved. I may need you to do some more snooping later, and I don't want your cover blown. I added, How are things with you otherwise? Oh, I'm fine, Kinsey. You needn't worry about me. I don't suppose you'd consider a partnership after we wrap this one up.
I've had worse offers in my day, I said.
Julia laughed. I'm going to start reading Mickey Spillane just to get in shape. I don't know a lot of rude words, you know.
I think I've got us covered on that score. I'll talk to you later. Let me know if you come up with anything startling in the meantime. Oh, and I'm shipping you a contract for your signature. We might as well do this right.
Roger. Over and out. She said, and hung up.
I left my vintage VW in the parking lot behind the office and walked over to the Tip Top Cab Company on Delgado. The business office is located in a narrow strip of stores best noted for their liquidation sales. A constant round of discount shoes, car stereos, lunch counters, and motorcycle shops with an occasional beauty salon or a fast photo establishment. It is not a desirable location. The one-way street runs the wrong way. The parking lot is too small, and apparently the owner of the building, while not exacting outrageous rents, is also content to let the premises languish under worn paint and tatty carpeting. Tip Top was jammed between a Humane Society thrift shop and a big and tall men's shop with a suit in the window designed for the steroid enthusiast. The office itself was long and narrow, partitioned across the middle with a plywood wall with a door cut into it. The place was furnished like some kid's hideout, complete with two broken-down couches and a table with one short leg. There were drawings and hand-lettered signs scotch-taped to the walls, trash piled up in one corner, dog-eared copies of Road and Track magazine in an irregular tier by the front door. The bucket seat from a car was propped against the far wall, tan upholstery slashed in one spot and mended with old band-aids covered with stars. The dispatcher was perched on a stool, leaning one elbow on a counter as littered as a workbench. He was probably 25, with curly black hair and a small dark mustache. He wore chinos, a pale blue T-shirt with a faded decal of the Grateful Dead, and a visor that made his hair stick up on the sides. The shortwave radio squawked incomprehensibly, and he took up the mic. 7-0, he said, his eyes immediately focusing on the map of the city affixed to the wall above the counter. I saw a butt-filled ashtray, an aspirin bottle, a cardboard calendar from Our Lady of Sorrows Church, a fan belt, plastic packets of ketchup, and a big penciled note that read, "Has anybody seen my red flashlight?" Tacked to the wall there was a list of addresses for customers who'd passed bad checks, and those in the habit of calling more than one cab to see who could get there first. There was a short burst of squawking, and the dispatcher moved a round magnet from one part of the map to another. It looked like he was playing a board game all by himself. He rotated toward me on the stool. "Yes, ma'am." I held up my hand. "I'm Kinsey Milhone," I said. He seemed slightly disconcerted at the notion of shaking hands, but he covered himself and gamely obliged. "Ron Coachello." I took out my wallet and showed him my identification. "I wonder if you could check some records for me." His eyes were very dark and bright, and his look said that he could check anything he wanted if it suited him. "What's the skinny?" I gave him the Reader's Digest condensed version of the tale, complete with Elaine Bolt's local address and the approximate time the taxi'd been there. "Can you go back to January 9th of this year and see if Tip Top picked up the fare? It might have been City Cab or Greenstripe. I've got some questions for the driver." He shrugged. "Sure. It might take a day. I got that stuff at home. I don't keep it down here. Why don't I give you a call? Or better yet, you buzz me back. How's that?" The phone rang, and he took a call, logging it in. Then he took up the mic and pressed the button. 6-8. He cocked his head, listening idly. There was static, then a squawk. 4029 Orion, he said, and clicked off. I gave him my card. He glanced at it with curiosity, as if he'd never known a woman with a business card before. The radio suddenly came to life again, and he turned back, taking up the mic. I waved to him, and he waved back over his shoulder at me. I went through exactly the same procedure with the other two cab companies, which were fortunately within walking distance of one another. By the time I repeated the same story twice more, I felt like I was suffering from a bad case of tongue flop. When I got into the office, there was a message from Jonah Robb on my machine. Yeah, Kinsey. This is Officer Robb on that, issue we discussed. I wonder if you could give me a call sometime, this afternoon, and we'll find a way to get together on it. It's now Friday, and it's, 12:10 p.m. Talk to you soon. Okay, thanks. The number he left was for the police station, with the extension for missing persons. I called him back, identifying myself as soon as he came on the line. I understand you have some information for me. Right, he said. You want to stop by my place later on? I could do that, I said. I took down his address, and we settled on 8:15, bypassing dinner. I didn't think we should get into any little domestic numbers at this point. I thanked him for his help and rang off. I couldn't for the life of me think of anything else to do on the case that afternoon, so I locked the office and headed for home. It was only 1:20, and since I'd accomplished so little at work, I felt morally obliged to be useful at my place. I washed the cup and saucer and plate that were sitting in the sink and left them in the rack to dry until I needed them again. I put a load of towels in the washer and then scoured the bathroom and kitchen sinks, took out the trash, and vacuumed a path around the furniture. Now and then I actually move things and suck up all the woofies underneath, but today it was sufficient to have a few vacuum cleaner tracks here and there and the apartment smelling of that peculiar cross between hot machine oil and cooked dust. I do love tidiness. When you live by yourself, you can either get all piggy or pick up as you go, which is what I prefer. There's nothing more depressing than coming home at the end of a long day to a place that looks like it's just been tossed by the mob. I changed into my sweatpants and did 3 miles with energy to burn. This was one of those rare days when the run seemed inexplicably grand. I came home, showered, washed my hair, napped, got dressed, sneaked in a little grocery shopping, and then I sat down at my desk and worked on note cards while I drank a glass of white wine and ate a warm, sliced, hard-boiled egg sandwich, with loads of Best Foods mayo and salt, nearly swooning at the taste. At 8, I snatched up a jacket, my handbag, and my key-pick, and hopped in my car, heading over to Cabana Boulevard, the wide avenue that parallels the beach. I turned right. Jonah lived in an odd little tract of houses off Primavera, maybe a mile away. I passed the marina, then Ludlow Beach, glancing to my left. Even in the gathering twilight, I could identify the big trash bin where death had almost caught up with me 2 weeks before. I wondered how long it would take before I could pass that area without unconsciously glancing left, without taking just that one peek at the place where I'd thought my life would end. The beach seemed to glow with the last light of day, and the sky was a silver-gray layered with pink and lavender, deepening to dark magenta where the near hills intersected the view. Out on the ocean, the islands retained a magical hot gold light, where lingering rivulets of sunlight formed a shimmering pool. I went up the hill, passing Seashore Park, turning right then into a tangle of streets across the boulevard. The proximity to the Pacific meant too much chill fog and corrosive salt air, but there was an elementary school close by. For Jonah, who had had a family to support on a cop's salary, the neighborhood was affordable, but by no means grand. I found the street number I was looking for and pulled into the driveway. The porch light was on, and the yard looked well kept. The house was a ranch-style stucco, painted slate blue with dark blue trim. I guessed there would be 3 bedrooms with maybe a patio in back. I rang the doorbell and Jonah came to the door. He wore jeans and an L.L. Bean Oxford cloth dress shirt with a pink pinstripe. He carried a beer bottle loosely by the neck, motioning me in with a glance at his watch.
"God, you're prompt," he said.
"Well, you're not far away. I just live at the bottom of the hill."
"I know. You want me to take that?"
He was holding his hand up for the jacket, which I shed and handed to him, along with my handbag. He tossed both unceremoniously into a chair. For a minute, neither of us could think of anything to say. He took a sip of beer. I put my hands in my back pockets. Why did this feel so awkward? It reminded me of those awful junior high school dates where you got driven to the movies by somebody's mother and you never knew what to talk about. I glanced around. "Nice house," I remarked.
"Come on, I'll show you around."
I followed while he talked back over his shoulder at me.
"It was a shit heap when we first moved in. The guy'd been renting it out to these weirdos who kept a ferret in the closet and never flushed the toilet because it was against their religious beliefs. You've probably seen him around town, barefoot with these red and yellow rags around their heads and outfits like something out of the Old Testament. He said they hardly ever paid their rent, but every time he came to hassle them about it, they'd start humming and hold his hand, making significant eye contact. You want some wine? I bought you some high-class stuff. No twist-off cap."
I smiled. "I'm flattered." We detoured into the kitchen, and he opened a bottle of white wine for me, pouring it into a wine glass that still had the price tag on the bottom. He grinned sheepishly when he saw it.
"All I had was plastic glasses the kids used to use in the backyard," he said. "This is the kitchen."
I kind of figured that. It was a nice house. I don't know what I expected, but someone had made good choices. The whole place had a stripped-down feeling. Bare, gleaming wood floors, furniture with simple lines, clean surfaces. Why had Camilla left this? What else was she looking for? He showed me 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, a deck out back, and a small yard enclosed by a vine-covered stucco wall.
"I'll tell you the truth," he said. "When she walked out, I packed up all her stuff and had the Salvation Army come take it away. I wasn't going to sit around looking at her little artsy-fartsy gewgaws. I kept the kids' rooms intact. Maybe she'll get tired of them like she got tired of me and send them back. But her stuff I don't need. She was royally irritated when she heard, but what was I supposed to do?"
He shrugged, standing there, holding the beer bottle by the neck. His face was beginning to take form, now that I'd seen him twice. Before, I'd only registered qualities like bland and harmless. I'd been aware of the extra weight he carried, a personality made up of something nice mixed with something droll. He was direct, and I responded to that, but he also had a trait I'd noticed in certain cops before. Bemused self-assurance, as if he were looking at the world from a long way back, but it was all okay with him. Clearly, Camilla still loomed large in his life, and he smiled every time he talked about her. Not with affection, but to cover his wrath. I thought he needed to go through a few more women before he got down to me.
"What is that? What's that look?" he asked.
I smiled.
"Beware of dog," I said.
I'm not sure if I was talking about him or me. He smiled too, but he knew what I meant.
"I got the stuff in here."
He pointed toward the dining room table in an alcove just off the living room. I sat down in a hot circle of light, feeling like a glutton with a napkin tucked under my chin and a knife and fork upright in each fist. Along with the reports he'd Xeroxed, he'd also managed to slip me some duplicate photographs.
I was going to see the aftermath of the crime with my own eyes, and I could hardly wait.
Chapter 14. I read through everything quickly, just to get an overview, and then I went back and noted the details that interested me. The official version of the story, as much as I knew it, and the interviews with Leonard Grice, his sister Lily, neighbors, the fire inspector, and the first police officer on the scene more or less spelled out events in the same way I'd been told. Leonard and Marty were scheduled to go out for their traditional Tuesday night dinner with Leonard's widowed sister, Mrs. Howe. Marty wasn't feeling well and canceled out at the last minute. Leonard and Lily went out as planned and got back to the house at about 9 p.m., at which point a call was put through to Marty to let her know they were home. Both Mr. Grice and his sister spoke to Marty, and she finally terminated the call in order to respond to a knock at the door. According to both Lily and Leonard, they had a cup of coffee and chatted for a bit. He left at approximately 10 o'clock, arriving at Via Madrina 20-some minutes later, to find that his house had burned. By then the blaze had been brought under control, and his wife's body was being removed from the partially destroyed residence. He collapsed and was revived by paramedics at the scene. Tilly Ahlberg was the one who'd spotted the smoke, and she'd turned in an alarm at 9:55. Two units had responded within minutes, but the blaze was such that entry couldn't be effected through the front door. Firemen had broken in through the rear, extinguishing the fire after 30 minutes or so. The body was discovered in the entryway and removed to the morgue. Identification had been established by full-mouth x-rays supplied by Marty's local dentist and through an examination of stomach contents. She'd apparently mentioned to Leonard on the phone that she'd fixed herself some canned tomato soup and a tuna sandwich. The empty cans were found in the kitchen wastebasket. The time of death had more or less been fixed in a narrow framework between the time of the telephone call and the time the fire alarm had been turned in. I read through the autopsy report, mentally summing up a lot of technical details. The pathologist reported no carbon granules deposited in the bronchial passages or lungs, and no carbon monoxide in the blood or other tissues. It was therefore determined that she had been dead when the fire broke out. Additional lab tests had revealed no alcohol, chloroform, drugs, or poisons in the system. The cause of death was attributed to multiple skull fractures, apparently caused by repeated blows with a blunt instrument. Because of the nature of the wounds, the pathologist estimated the object to be some 4 to 5 inches in width, speculating that it might have been a 2x4 wielded with great force, a baseball bat, or some kind of club, possibly metal. The murder weapon had never been found. Unless, of course, it was a big old board burned up in the fire, but there was no evidence to support that possibility. The arson investigators didn't seem to have any doubts that the fire had been deliberately set. Lab tests showed traces of kerosene in the floorboards. Charring patterns throughout the house had borne this out. They'd seen the same blackened splash marks and the same liquid trails that I'd spotted when I went through the house earlier. They'd also used some sophisticated methods of verifying the point of origin and the course the fire had taken as it burned. Leonard Grice had been questioned about the kerosene, and he said he'd been storing a quantity in the basement for use in 2 lamps and a cooking stove that he and Marty took on camping trips, which accounted for the intruders having had access to a flammable liquid. It looked as if the burglar had come with a weapon in hand, but without any intention of burning the place down. The fire was apparently an afterthought, a hastily concocted plan to conceal the bludgeoning of Marty Grice. So far, there was nothing to suggest that anybody knew she'd be there, so the cops were having a hard time imagining that the murder had been planned in advance. There was no evidence that a time delay device had been employed, which ruled out the possibility that Grice had rigged the fire before he left. Grice's nephew Mike had been questioned and cleared. He'd been seen by numerous impartial witnesses in a hangout called the Clockworks in downtown Santa Teresa during the critical period when experts speculated that the fire had been set. There were no other suspects and no other witnesses. Any other hard evidence, including fingerprints, had been destroyed by the fire. Elaine Bolt's name was on a list of persons to be interviewed, and there was a note that Lieutenant Dolan had contacted her by telephone on the 5th. He'd made an appointment to see her on January 10th, but she'd never appeared. According to the information I had, she'd left for Florida the night before. One entry, appearing in the middle of a typed report, interested me considerably. According to a deputy at the police department, a call had come in at 9:06 on the night of the murder that might well have been placed by Marty Grice. The caller had been female, in a panic, and had blurted out a cry for help before the phone went dead. Since the call was placed to the police station instead of 911, the deputy had no way of getting a fix on the address from which the call had originated. She'd made a note of it, however, and when the murder came to light, she'd reported it to Dolan, who had included it in his report. He'd questioned Grice about that, too. If it was Marty, why would she have called the station instead of dialing 911? Leonard had pointed out that he and Marty had a telephone answering machine with a rapid dial function. She'd entered the telephone numbers of both the police department and the fire department. The answering machine was found, undamaged, on a table in the rear of the hallway, with the numbers neatly printed on the index. It looked as if Marty had had some warning of the attack and had been able to reach the telephone, calling out at least part of a distress signal before she'd been killed. If she'd actually placed the call, it pinpointed the time of death at 9:06, or soon afterward. For a moment, I harbored the fleeting hope that Leonard Grice might still be implicated. After all, as nearly as I could tell, the police had only Lily's word for the fact that he was still at her place at that time. I was speculating that he might have come home early, killed Marty, started the fire, and then parked around the block until the appropriate moment to arrive. If he and his sister were in cahoots, they could both simply maintain afterward that he'd been with her. I was out of luck on that one. Three interviews down, there was a short paragraph detailing a conversation that Dolan had had with some of Lily's neighbors, who stopped by unexpectedly at 9 p.m. to drop off a birthday present. The husband and wife both reported independently that Leonard was there and hadn't left for home until approximately 10. The time was noted because they'd been trying to persuade him to stay for a television program that came on at 10. It turned out to be a rerun, and since he was anxious to get home to his wife anyway, he'd left. Well, shit, I thought. Now, why was this making me feel so cross? Ah, well, because I wanted Leonard Grice to be guilty of something. Murder, conspiracy to murder, accessory to murder. I was fond of the idea for tidiness' sake, for statistical purposes, if nothing else. California has over 3,000 homicide victims annually, and of those, fully two-thirds are slain by friends, acquaintances, or relatives, which makes you wonder if you might be better off as a friendless orphan in this state. The point is, when a murder goes down, the chances are good that someone near and dear has had a hand in it. I thought about that, reluctant to give it up. Could Grice have hired someone to kill his wife? It was always possible, of course, but it was hard to see what he might have gained. The police, not being ignorant buffoons, had pursued the line as well, but had come up with nothing. No monies unaccounted for, no meetings with unsavory characters, no apparent motive, no visible benefit. Which brought me back to Elaine Bolt. Could she have been involved in Marty Grice's death? Most of what I'd learned about her cried out a big resounding no. There really wasn't a hint that she'd been attached to Leonard romantically, or any other way, except as an occasional bridge partner. I didn't think Marty Grice had been killed for messing up a small slam, but with bridge players one can never tell. Wim Hoover had mentioned that Elaine and Beverly had quarreled about a man at Christmas time, but it was hard to picture the two of them in an arm wrestle over Leonard Grice. I kept coming back to the same suspicion. that Elaine knew something or had seen something related to Marty's murder, and had left town to avoid the scrutiny of the Santa Teresa police. I turned my attention to the photographs, neatly disconnecting my brain. I needed to know how things had looked, and I couldn't afford to react emotionally. Violent death is repellent. My first impulse, always, is to turn abruptly away, to shield my soul from the sight. But this was the only tangible record of that event, and I had to see for myself. I turned a cold eye to the first black-and-white photograph. The color pictures would be worse, and I thought I'd start with the easy ones. Jonah cleared his throat. I looked up.
"I'm going to have to turn in," he said. "I'm beat."
"You are?" I glanced at my watch, startled. It was 10:45. I'd been sitting there for more than 2 hours without moving. "I'm sorry," I said. "I had no idea I'd been here that long."
"That's okay. I got up at 5 this morning to work out, and I need some shut-eye. You can take that stuff if you like. Of course, if Dolan ever catches you with it, I'll deny everything and throw you to the wolves. But aside from that, I hope it helps."
"Thanks. It's already helped." I shoved the photographs and reports into a big manila envelope and tucked that, in turn, in my handbag. I drove home, disturbed. Even now there was an image of Marty's body graven behind my eyes, features blurred by charring, mouth open, lying in a circle of ash like a pile of gray confetti. The heat had caused the tendons in her arms to retract, pulling her fists up into a pugilistic pose. It was her last fight, and she had lost, but I didn't think it was over yet. I willed the image away, running back over what I'd learned to that point. One little detail still bothered me. Was it possible that May Snyder had been accurate when she talked about the bang, bang, bang of hammering that night? If so, what in the world could it have been? I was almost home again when I remembered the shed in the Grice's backyard. I slammed the brakes on and hung a hard left, heading across town. Via Madrina was dark, heavily overhung by Italian stone pines. There wasn't much traffic at that hour. The night sky was hazy, and though the moon was full, the light that filtered down was partially blocked by the condominium next door. I parked and got a little penlight out of the glove compartment. I pulled on a pair of rubber gloves and locked my car, heading up the Grice's front walk. I cut around the side of the house, my tennis shoes making no sound at all on the concrete. In my jacket pocket, I fingered the key pick, shaped like a flattened metal mandolin. I had a set of 5 picks with me on a key ring, and a second, more elaborate set at home in a nice leather case. They'd been given to me by a non-residential burglar who was currently serving 10 months in the county jail. Last time he'd been caught, he'd hired me to keep an eye on his wife, whom he believed was misbehaving with the guy next door. Actually, she hadn't been doing anything, and he was so grateful for the good news that he gave me the key picks and taught me how to use them. He'd paid me some cash, too, but then it turned out he'd stolen it and he had to ask for it back when the judge ordered him to make restitution. It was chilly, and there was a frisky little breeze making breathy sounds in the pine boughs. The house behind the Grices had canvas awnings that were snapping like sails, and the hollow sigh of dry grass gave the whole enterprise an eerie ambience of its own. I was feeling jumpy anyway because I'd just been looking at pictures of a charbroiled corpse, and here I was about to do a little breaking and entering number that could land me in jail and cause my license to be snatched away. If the next-door neighbors set up a howl and the cops arrived on the scene, what was I going to say? Why was I doing it anyway? Ah, because I wanted to know what was in this wee metal house, and I couldn't figure out how else to get in. I fixed a tiny beam of light on the bottom of the padlock. In the diagram my burglar friend had drawn of a lock like this, there is a flat hairpin spring that latches into notches in the shackle. Usually only the tip of the key actuates the spring, so it was a question of figuring out which of my picks would spread the latch apart, releasing the mechanism. In truth, I could have tried a paperclip with a small L bent on one end, but that was the shape of the first pick I used, and the padlock wouldn't budge. I tried the next pick, which had an H shape in the point. Nope. I tried the third, working it carefully. The lock popped open in my hand. I checked my watch. 1 minute and a half. I get a bit vain about these things. The shed door made a wrenching sound when I opened it, and I stood for a moment, heart thudding in my throat. I heard a motorcycle putter past in the street, but I didn't pay much attention to it because I had just understood Mike's custodial relationship to his uncle's property. In the shed, along with a stack of clay pots, the hand-push lawnmower, and a weed whacker, were 6 shelves crammed with illegal drugs. Mason jars full of reds and dexies, yellow jackets, rainbows, and soapers. Along with some fat plastic packets of grass and hashish. Well, this was all just too yummy for words. I didn't think Leonard Grice was the druggist, but I was willing to bet money his nephew had invested heavily in this little portable Rexall. I was so enamored of my discovery that I didn't know he was behind me until he let out an astonished, "Hey!" I jumped back and whipped around, suppressing a shriek. I found myself face to face with the kid, his green eyes glowing in the dark like a cat's. He was as startled to see me as I was to see him. Fortunately, neither of us was armed, or we might have had a quick duel, doing each other a lot of needless harm. "What are you doing?" he said. He sounded outraged, as if he couldn't believe this was happening. His mohawk was beginning to grow out, and the wind was making it lean slightly to the left, like a field of tall grass in one of those old commercials for Kotex. He had on a black leather motorcycle jacket and a rhinestone earring. His boots were knee-high and made of plastic scored to resemble cobra skin, only looking more like psoriasis. It was hard to take this lad seriously, but in some odd way I did. I closed the shed door and snapped the padlock into place. What could he prove? "I got curious about what you were doing back here, so I thought I'd take a peek."
"You mean you just broke in?" he said.
His voice had that adolescent crack left over from puberty, and his cheeks were hot pink.
"You can't do that!"
"Mike, sweetie, I just did," I said. "You're in big trouble." He stared at me for a moment, his expression blank.
"You gonna call the cops?"
"Shit, yes."
"But what you did is just as much against the law as this," he said.
I could tell he was one of those bright boys accustomed to arguing righteously with adults. "Oh, crap," I said. "Wise up. I'm not going to stand out here and argue the California Penal Code with you. You're dealing drugs. The cops aren't going to care what I was up to. Maybe I was passing by and thought you were breaking in yourself. You're out of business, kiddo." His eyes took on a shrewd look, and he changed his tack.
"Well, now, wait a minute. Don't go so fast. Why can't we talk about this?"
"Sure, why not? What's to say?" I could practically see his brain cells scurry around forming a new thought. He was no fool, but he still surprised me with the line he took.
"Are you looking into Aunt Marty's death? Is that why you're here?"
Aunt Marty. Nice touch, I thought. I smiled briefly. "Not quite, but that's close enough." He glanced off toward the street, then down at the toe of his cobra boot.
"Because I got something, you know, like some information about that."
"What kind of information?"
"Something I never told the cops. So maybe we could make a trade," he said.
He stuck his hands in his jacket pockets, looking back at me. His face was innocent, his complexion clear, the look in his eyes so pure I'd have given him my firstborn if I'd had one. The little smile that crossed his face was engaging, and I wondered how much money he'd made selling dope to his high school friends. And I wondered if he was going to end up with a bullet in his head for cheating someone higher up in the scheme of things. I was interested in what he had to say, and he knew it. I had to make quick peace with my own corruption, and it wasn't that hard to do. Times like this, I know I've been in the business too long.
"What kind of trade?" "Just give me time to clear this stuff out before you tell anyone. I was about to lay off anyway because the narcs have some undercover agents at our school, and I thought I'd cool it till the pressure's off."
"We're not talking permanent reform here, folks. We're talking simple expediency. But at least the kid wasn't trying to con me. Too much." We looked at each other, and something shifted. I knew I could rail and stomp and threaten him.
I knew I could be pious and moralistic and disapproving, and it wouldn't change a thing. He knew the score as well as I did, and what we had to offer each other might not be a bad bet on either side. All right, you got it, I said. Let's go somewhere and talk, he said. I'm freezing my nuts off. It bothered me to realize that I'd started to like him just a little bit.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
Chapter 15. We went to the Clockworks on State Street, he on his motorcycle, with me following in my car. The place is a teen hangout and looks like something out of a rock video. A long, narrow room painted charcoal gray, with a high ceiling, and the lighting done in pink and purple neon tubing. The whole of it resembles the interior of a clock in abstract and futuristic forms. There are mobiles looking like big black gears suspended from the ceiling, the smoke in the air moving them in slow circles. There are four small tables near the door, and on the left are what look like shelves at chest height in a series of standing-room-only booths where couples can neck while drinking soda pop. The menu posted on the wall is larded with side orders like dinner salad and garlic toast that kids can snack on, paying 75 cents for the privilege of taking up table space for hours at a time. You can also buy two kinds of beer and a house Chablis if you are old enough and have tangible proof. It was now nearly midnight, and there were only two other people in the place, but the owner apparently knew Mike, and his gaze slid over to me appraisingly. I tried to look like I was not Mike's date. I didn't mind a May-December romance now and then, but a 17-year-old is pushing it some. Also, I'm not clear on the etiquette of making deals with junior dope peddlers. Who pays for the drinks? I didn't want his self-image to suffer. "What do you want?" he asked, moving toward the counter. "Chablis is fine," I said. He was already pulling his wallet out, so I let him pay. He probably made 30 grand a year selling grass and pills. The owner looked over at me again, and I waved my ID at him casually, indicating that he could card me, but he'd be wasting a trip across the room. Mike came back with a plastic glass of white wine for me and a soft drink for himself. He sat down surveying the place for narcs in disguise. He seemed strangely mature, and I was having trouble dealing with the incongruity of a kid who looked like a Boy Scout and behaved like a mafia management trainee. He turned toward me then, resting both elbows on the table. He'd taken up a sugar packet from the container on the table, and he tapped it and turned it restlessly, addressing most of what he had to say to the trivia question printed on the back. "Okay, here's what happened," he said, "and I'm telling you the truth. For one thing, I didn't stash at Uncle Leonard and Aunt Marty's until after she got killed and he moved out. Once the cops got done and everything, it occurred to me that the utility shed was perfect, so I moved some stuff in. Anyway, I went by the house the night she got killed." "Did she know you were coming?" "Nuh-uh. I'm getting to that. I mean, I knew they went out on Tuesday nights and I thought they'd be gone. Like, you know, if I was hard up and needed some bucks or something, I might cruise by and pick up some loose change. They kept cash around. Not a lot, but enough. Or sometimes I'd take something I could unload somewhere else. Nothing they'd miss, and nobody'd ever said anything about it, so I figured they hadn't tipped to it yet. Anyway, what happened was I went over there that night thinking the place would be empty. But when I got there, the door was open." "The door was standing open?" He shook his head. "I just kind of turned the knob and it was unlocked. When I stuck my head in, I knew something weird was going on." I waited, watching him uneasily. He cleared his throat, looking over his shoulder at the front entrance. His voice dropped. "I think the guy was still there, you know? The light was on in the basement, and I could hear someone knocking around down there. And there was this rug in the hall, like an area rug that had been thrown over something. I saw a hand sticking out with blood on it. Man, I took off." "You're pretty sure she was dead at that point?" He nodded, hanging his head. He ran a hand along the pink center divider of hair, looking off to one side. "I should have called the cops. I knew I should, but the whole thing really freaked me out. I hate that shit. And what was I supposed to do?
I couldn't tell the cops anything, and I didn't want them looking at me, so I just kept my mouth shut. I mean, I couldn't see what difference it made. I didn't see who did it or anything like that.
Do you remember anything else? A car parked out front?
I don't know. I didn't stay long. I took one look at that shit and I was gone. I could smell all these gasoline fumes or something and...
He hesitated briefly.
Wait a minute, yeah. There was a brown grocery bag in the hall, too. I don't know what it was doing there. I mean, I didn't know what the fuck was happening, so I just backed away real quiet and came on down here and made sure people saw me.
I took a sip of wine, running through his story. The Chablis tasted like fermented grapefruit juice. Tell me about the grocery bag. Was it empty, full, crumpled?
It had stuff in it, I think. I mean, I didn't see anything in particular. It was one of those brown paper bags from Alpha Beta, standing just inside the door to the right.
Did it look like she'd been shopping? Is that what you're trying to say?
He shrugged. It just looked like junk, I guess. I don't know. Maybe it belonged to whoever was down in the basement.
Too bad you didn't make an anonymous call to the cops. Maybe they could have gotten there before the place went up in smoke.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that later, and I was bummed I didn't do that, but I wasn't thinking straight.
He polished off his soft drink and rattled the ice in the cup, tilting a cube into his mouth. I could hear the ice crunching in his teeth. It sounded like a horse chewing on a bit. Do you remember anything else?
No, I guess that's it. Once I figured out what was going on, I backed out of there and hightailed it down here as fast as I could.
You have any idea what time it was?
Nuh-uh. Not exactly. It was 9:15 when I got here, and it probably took me 10 minutes on the motorcycle by the time I found a place to park and all like that. I had to walk this sucker for 2 blocks so nobody would hear me start it up. It was probably 8:30 or something like that when I left Uncle Leonard's house.
I shook my head. Not 8:30. You must mean 9:30. She wasn't killed until after 9. He took the cup away from his mouth, looking at me with puzzlement.
She wasn't?
Your uncle and Mrs. Howe both say they talked to her at 9, and the cops took a call they think was from your aunt at 9:06.
Well, maybe I got it wrong then, because I thought it was 9:15 when I got here. I looked at the clock when I walked in, and then I turned around and asked this buddy of mine what time it was, and he checked his watch.
I'll see if I can check that out, I said.
By the way, how's Leonard related to you?
My dad and him are brothers. Dad's the youngest in his family.
So Lily Howe is their sister.
Something like that.
The purple neon tubes began to blink out in succession, and the pink ones went dark after that. The owner of the place called over to the table.
"Closing down in 10 minutes, Mike. Sorry to break it up."
"That's okay. Thanks, man."
We got up, moving toward the back entrance. He was not much taller than I, and I wondered if we looked like brother and sister or mother and son. I didn't say anything else until we got to the parking lot.
You have any theories about who killed your aunt?
No, do you?
I shook my head.
I'd get that shed cleaned out if I were you.
Yeah, sure. That was the deal, wasn't it?
He got on his cycle and did one of those jumps to start it up.
Hey, you know what? I don't remember your name.
I gave him my card, then got into my VW. He waited to make sure I was underway, and then he roared off. I intended to let the case sit for the weekend because I wasn't sure what else to do. Saturday morning I went over the police reports again at home, adding note cards to my collection up on the bulletin board, but for the time being I simply had to sit it out. Come Monday, it was possible I'd get a response from the classified ads I'd placed in the Florida papers, or maybe I'd hear from the DMV in Tallahassee or Sacramento. I was still waiting for the plane ticket Julia Oxner had mailed, hoping it would give me information of some kind. If nothing new came to light, I was going to have to start all over again and see if I could develop a few new leads. I still had local vets to check, trying to get a rundown on the cat. I took a few minutes to do recalls on the 3 cab companies.
The dispatcher I'd talked to at Greenstripe said he hadn't had a chance to dig through his files yet. The owner of CityCab had looked and found nothing, and Ron Coachella at Tip Top wasn't in yet. But the dispatcher on duty said he'd be in shortly. So much for that. I went down to the office. I hadn't meant to, but I couldn't help myself. I was feeling itchy and restless and dissatisfied. I don't like not succeeding at things. California Fidelity was closed for the weekend. I unlocked my door and picked up the mail that had been shoved through the slot. There was an envelope with Julia Oxner's return address on it. I tossed it on the desk while I checked my messages. There was only one, and it had apparently just come in. "Hello, Kinsey. This is Ron Coachella over at the cab company. I got the information you want. Tip Top did pick up the fare at 2097 Via Madrina. Let's see, on January the 9th at 10:14 p.m. Driver's name was Nelson Aquistapache at 5556317. I told him you'd be in touch. I've got the trip sheet down here, and you're welcome to stop by and pick up a copy so he can look at it. $20 might help his memory, if you know what I mean. Aside from that, just remember, if you want the top ride in town, call Tip Top, he sang, and hung up. I smiled, making a note of the driver's name and number. I put on a pot of coffee and opened the note from Julia. Her handwriting was of the old school, surprisingly firm, a clear cursive with grand flourishes and well-formed capital letters. She said she was enclosing the ticket, that the June rains were in full force, and that Charmaine Makowski had given birth to a 9-pound, 9-ounce boy the night before, and wanted everyone to know that she never expected to sit down again. Charmaine and Roland had not yet named the child, but were accepting suggestions. Julia said that most of the appellations proffered so far were not fit to repeat. Julia thought it was a hoot. "Warmest regards," said she. I studied the ticket, which was tucked in a TWA folder. It looked like it had been generated at the Santa Teresa Airport, round trip from Santa Teresa to LAX, and from LAX to Miami. All 4 flight coupons had been removed, but the carbon remained. The ticket had been paid for by credit card. 4 flight coupons torn out. Now that was interesting. Had she come back to town at some point? If so, why had the carbon been down in Boca Raton in Pat Usher's trash? I went back to my list of travel agents, trying to figure out which one Elaine Bolt ordinarily used. I decided on Santa Teresa Travel, which has an office within easy walking distance of the condominium on Via Madrina. It was just a guess, but I had to start someplace. I put in a call, but there was no answer, and I assumed the agency was shut down for the weekend. I made a list of leads to pursue on Monday. I checked the ticket again. I didn't see any indication that she'd had the cat in tow, but I wasn't sure how that worked. Did kitty cats get tickets like everybody else? I'd have to ask. There were some luggage tags still stapled to the back of the folder, but that doesn't mean much. At the airport here in town, you can pick up your bags without anybody verifying the tags. I remembered Elaine's luggage was fairly distinctive anyway. Dark red leather with the designer signature writ large on the fabric trim. I'd priced that stuff once and decided to open a Keo account instead. I put a call through to Nelson Aquistapache, the tip-top cab driver. He was home in bed with a head cold, but said Ron had told him what I needed. He had to pause and blow his nose twice.
"Why don't you pick up the trip sheet and bring it over here? I'm on Delgado, just a half a block down from Tip Top," he said. "I'll be outside, around and back."
I picked up the trip sheet and arrived at his place by 9:35. I found him sitting in the backyard of a white frame bungalow, tucked into a jungle of overgrown pittosporum bushes. He was lying on a hammock in a freestanding metal frame in the only patch of sunlight. The rest of the property was in deep shade, rather chilly and uninviting. He looked to be in his 60s, balding, heavy-set, in a dark green velour bathrobe. He had a square of pink-sprigged flannel on his chest, and he smelled like Vicks VapoRub.
He'd set up a small metal table with his cold remedies, a box of Kleenex, an empty juice glass, and some crossword puzzle books that I recognized.
"I know the guy who writes those puzzles," I said. "He's my landlord."
His eyebrows shot up.
"This guy lives in town here? He's a whiz. He drives me up the wall with these things. Look at this one. 18th century English novelists, and he includes all their books and their characters and everything. I had to go read Henry Fielding and Lawrence Stern and people I never even heard about just to get through the thing. It's better than a college education, I'm telling you. What is he, some kind of professor?"
I shook my head, feeling absurdly proud. You'd have thought Henry was a rock star the way this guy was reacting.
"He used to run that little bakery at the corner of State and Purdue. He started doing the crossword puzzles when he retired."
"Is that right? You sure it's the same guy? Henry Pitts?"
I laughed. "Sure, I'm sure. He tries those things out on me all the time. I don't think I've ever finished one yet."
"You tell him I want to meet him sometime. He has a very twisted sense of humor, but I like that. He did one all made up of botanical oddities. Remember that? I went crazy. I was up all night. I can't believe the guy lives here in Santa Teresa. I thought he was a full professor at MIT, someplace like that."
"I'll tell him you said that. He'll be thrilled to hear he has a fan."
"You tell him to stop by here any time. Tell him Nelson Acquistapace is at his service. He needs a cab, just call Tip Top and ask for me."
"I'll do that," I said.
"You got the trip sheet? Ron said you were looking for some lady who disappeared. Is that right?"
I took the trip sheet out of my purse and passed it over to him.
"Don't get too close, sweetheart," he said.
He took a handkerchief out of his robe pocket and dusted his nose with it, honking into it before he put it back. He unfolded the sheet, holding it at arm's length to look at it.
"I left my glasses inside. Which one?"
I pointed to the Via Madrina address.
"Yeah, I remember her, I think. I took her to the airport and dropped her off. I remember she was picking up that last flight from here to L.A. Where was she going? I forget now."
"Miami, Florida."
"Yeah, that's right. I remember now."
He was studying the trip sheet as though it were a pack of tarot cards in some tricky configuration.
"You know what this is?"
He was tapping the paper.
"You want to know why this fare is so high? Look at that. $16. It doesn't cost that much to go from Via Madrina to the airport. She made a stop and had me wait maybe 15 minutes with the meter running. An intermediate stop. Now, just let me think where it was. Not far. Someplace on Chapel. Okay, yeah, I got it now. That clinic down near the freeway."
"A clinic?" That took me by surprise.
"Yeah, you know, an emergency facility. For the cat. She dropped him off for some kind of emergency treatment, and then she got back in the cab and we took off."
"I don't suppose you actually saw her get on the plane, did you?"
"Sure. I was done for the night. You can see for yourself from the trip sheet. She was my last fare, so I went upstairs to the airport bar and had a couple beers out on the patio. I told her I was going to be up there, so she even turned around and waved at me when she was walking out to the plane."
"Was she alone?"
"As far as I could tell."
"Had you ever picked her up before?"
"Not me. I just moved up here from L.A. in November last year. This is paradise. I love this town."
"Well," I said, "I appreciate your help. At least we know she got on the plane. I guess now the question is, did she ever reach Boca Raton?"
"That's where she said she was going," he said. "Though I tell you something. With that fur coat, I told her she ought to head someplace cold. Get some use out of it." She laughed.
I felt myself hit the pause button mentally, a quick freeze frame. It was odd, that image, and it bothered me. I pictured Elaine Bolt with her fur coat and turban on her way to warmth and sunshine, waving back over her shoulder to the taxi driver who'd taken her to the airport. It was disturbing somehow, that last glimpse of her, and I realized that until now I hadn't really pictured that at all. I'd been weighing the possibility that she was on the run. But in my heart of hearts,
I pictured her dead. I'd kept thinking that whoever killed Marty Grice killed her, too. I just couldn't figure out why. Now the uncertainty had crept in again. Something was off, but I couldn't figure out what it was. Chapter 16. Well, at least now I had a tiny mission in life. When I left Nelson, he was taking his temperature with a digital thermometer, confessing sheepishly a secret addiction to gadgets like that. I wished him a speedy recovery and hopped in my car, circling back around to Chapel. The veterinary clinic is a small box of glass and cinder block painted the color of window putty and tucked into the dead end formed when Highway 101 was cut through. I love that whole series of dead-end streets, relics of the town as it used to be, a refreshing departure from the pervading Spanish look. The small frame houses in that neighborhood are actually Victorian cottages, built for the working class, with hand-turned porch rails, exotic trim, wooden shutters, and peaked roofs. They look like shabby antiques now, but it's still possible to imagine a day when they were newly constructed and covered with fresh paint, the full-grown trees no more than slender saplings planted in the midst of newly seeded lawns. The town then must have been dirt roads and carriages. I'm not above wishing more of it remained. I parked in the lot behind the clinic and went in through the back door. I could hear dogs barking hoarsely somewhere in the rear. Shrill cries for mercy, freedom, and relief. There were only two animals in the waiting room, both bored-looking cats who had formed themselves into bolster pillows. Their humans spoke to them in what was apparently cat English, using high-pitched voices that made my own head hurt. Now and then, when some dog set up a howl in the back, one or the other of the cats would appear to smile faintly. There must have been two vets working because both cats got called at the same time and were carted off down the hall, leaving me alone with the receptionist behind the counter. She was in her late 20s, blue-eyed, pale, with an Alice in Wonderland blue ribbon across her straight blonde hair. Her name tag read Emily.
"May I help you?"
She spoke as though she'd never progressed beyond the age of 6. A breathy, wispy tone, softly modulated, perhaps especially cultivated to soothe distressed beasts. Occasionally I run into women who talk like that, and it's always puzzling, this perpetual girlhood in a world where the rest of us are struggling to grow up. Dealing with her made me feel like a linebacker. "I wonder if you could give me some information."
"Well, I'll try," she whispered.
Her voice was sweet and musical.